The Bob Siegel Show, sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but your liberal friends keep telling you that in the 21st century, it's difficult to take miracles seriously. Yes, indeed, many liberals claim they do not believe in miracles, but two New Testament-style miracles seem to pop up during election years. First, dead people are being resurrected long enough to vote. Then they return to their grave. Second, just as Jesus multiplied the fish and the loaves, new votes seem to come in from out of nowhere in Florida, votes by an amazing, incredible coincidence for the Democrat candidate. Go figure, it's amazing. And now here to offer a much more honest assessment of last Tuesday's election, National Review contributor Mike Friedenberg.
Well, Bob, no blue wave, but not quite the results we were hoping for. I was hoping to just barely hang on to the House and actually just looking if we had, you know, averaged a couple points across the board, we would have come very more Republican turnout, a couple points less Democrat turnout, we would have held. It was very close.
It was. And, you know, with both of us, we both leaned a little bit toward the hope of keeping the House, but we were not super strong about it. You were emphatic that we were going to keep the Senate. And we did, although that's being chipped away at, we should say.
It is being chipped away at. I mean, if, you know, election night, we were sitting at 23 seats, you know, and the House has been called for the Democrats. And now it looks like, and this is pretty confident, plus or minus one, it looks like the Democrats are going to pick up 35 seats in the House. That's where we're going to be sitting.
Wow, that's not great.
And we'll put that in perspective in a second here. And then the Senate, we're going to keep the Senate, but it's not going to be, we're not going to be sitting with 55 or 56.
Which means people like Mitt Romney can reach across the aisle and still screw things up when we have conservative judges nominated.
It gives folks like that more power. But let's just sit here and you know, take a look where we're at. First of all, you know, starting, we went into the election at 51 and 49, 47 Democrats and two independents that always vote with the Democrats. So it started 51-49 on election night. And then we did pick up four. We did take out four incumbent Democrat senators, which was very impressive, right? And so that took us to, you know, if you just, we're going to kind of do a plus minus. Without looking at anything else, that takes us to 55, right? But then we lost an incumbent Republican senator out in Nevada. Yeah, Heller, Dean Heller against Rosen and Jackie Rosen. So that took us, you know, so now we're down to 54. Then we had a couple open seats. We had an open seat in Arizona. And that one now is almost certainly going to go to the Democrats.
So when is the last time we had a Democrat senator from Arizona?
I'm not sure, but Jeff Flake was that we, you know, did not run for election.
He was more or less like a Democrat.
And we're
going to
spend some more time talking about that race, which was, you know, Martha McSally against.
Hey, did you hear Jeff Flake's thinking of running against Trump in the next presidential election?
Yes, I did. Yes. Against Sinema. So that one, you know, we were ahead on election night and we're going to spend some time talking about Arizona, what's happening there. But that one's not going to, I'm almost sure that's not going to go for us. So That takes us down to 53 seats. And we did hold the seat in Tennessee. That was an open seat. So that does give us a plus or minus because, you know, it was an open seat. But we were going to keep that. So that was good. That Marshall Blackburn.
And Ted Cruz beat out that Beto O'Dork. Yeah, so yeah, that was good.
That was, if we'd lost that, that would have been very bad. So, and then we're sitting at, looking at, getting very, very close in Florida, you know, with Rick Scott against the incumbent Senator Nelson. And if we were to, if we lose that one, we're down to 52. Now that is the worst case scenario, I believe, is that we pick up plus one Senate seats. I think it's very realistic that we could pick up keep the Nelson seat. So we're going to be, you know, we could be sitting at plus two at this whole thing, but it's either plus one or plus two. Remember, the norm for a midterm election after the president's first led to the president's party first is to lose 3.7 seats. So if we pick up two, it's still a win. We still keep the Senate, and we've been able to get a lot of judges approved with a 51-49. So we're going to be in better shape for that.
Yeah,
so
I'm still bothered by the damage a Mitt Romney can be there. I think he's going to anoint himself the new John McCain.
He will. I am. Yeah. So I probably concur with you. I think that he will not miss a chance to be disrespectful to the president, not miss a chance to criticize him, not miss a chance to engage in some sort of passive aggressive behavior. He still does not like Trump, I can guarantee you. So I agree with you on that.
Well, how much do you hold Paul Ryan responsible for our loss of the House? I think he has at least a good deal of the responsibility.
Listen, okay, he certainly was the divisive force. He did not get behind the president's agenda. He came into the House after Trump won the presidency talking about his better way and ignoring Make America Great, you know. And then, you know, he would never, ever really get behind the immigration reform agenda that the American people want. And it, by the way, that syncs up very well with what Donald Trump wants. If you look at the polling, what Donald Trump has proposed for immigration reform polls very well. For some reason, Paul Ryan could not get behind that. However, to be fair, even if he had gotten something through the House, there's no way our Senate would have actually approved a significant immigration
bill. But we wouldn't have had angry conservative voters trying to teach the House a lesson, which I don't agree with because it puts the Democrats in power. But I do understand it. And we talked about this a little last week. There were an awful lot of people who could have run as incumbents in the House who retired. And I didn't see Paul Ryan doing much to talk them out of it, not to mention the fact that he retired himself. It is easier for an incumbent to win than to win in an open seat.
He refused to give up the leadership position. So he was a lame duck leader.
I know.
Which greatly reduced his
effectiveness. Wasn't it like 6 months ago that he resigned?
Yes,
what the heck has he been doing in there all this time?
And so his ability to raise funds, as being a lame duck, your ability to raise funds, to wield power is greatly reduced. So he did us no favors by staying in there. If we had brought in a new leader, let's say like Kevin McCarthy, possibly, or Jordan, it's probably going to be Kevin McCarthy. And I think Kevin McCarthy will be a big upgrade over Paul Ryan.
Yeah, I would rather have Jordan than McCarthy.
McCarthy has been very supportive of the president. Very supportive. I mean, 100%. So he's been solid. I would rather have Jordan. I agree. But McCarthy has been good. So, no, he did not. He certainly did not help. He was one of the reasons he certainly did not help us. Stepping back for a second, there was a Democrat surge. It was a large Democrat surge. And if there had not been some factors that counter that surge, we would have had a blue wave. I mean, the surge was very large. It was not small. And, but what you give me an idea here in, the midterm in 2014, we had 75 million people vote. So that's the last midterm. In this midterm, we had 101 million people vote. This is the biggest midterm by far. It's not even close. It's not, you know, huge. There was a massive turnout in this midterm.
Yeah, we usually do not have that much interest in a midterm.
Right. So this was sort of a hybrid, as I mentioned in our last show. This was sort of a hybrid between a midterm and a general election because it was nationalized. The election had been nationalized by the Democrats and
it was definitely a referendum on Trump.
It was about Trump to a large degree, yes. And also about the Democrats, though. So that's because they've also been doing some things that I don't think have really helped themselves. But to give you an idea, in 2014, 35 million Democrats voted in the midterm. In 2018, 53 million voted. Okay. Now, we did have an increase in Republicans. It went from 40 million to 48 million. Okay. And in 2014, you know, that was not a good year for the Democrats particularly. It was a bit of a down year. But still, it was a big surge. So, but I think there's three factors that countered the surge that made this election, that took this election from being a complete disaster to being, you know, listen, if I had to hold.
It was almost like a draw when you look at the whole
thing. Close to a draw. But the fact is we lost seats in the House, but we did gain, we're going to gain some Senate seats. We're going to control the Senate. But the three factors are one is, and this one just was turned out to be fortuitous, is the Democrats blew it on Kavanaugh, and we had
they've been overreaching a lot.
They were overreached on Kavanaugh, and that did energize the Republican base, and I think it energized some independents as well. Then we had, you know, we were defending, you know, we had more red state incumbents than the Democrats had blue state incumbents. So we were defending home turf a little better. But the reason we had red state incumbents is because Trump did so well in some of these states that, you know, he's not traditionally done well in. So that was actually good. And then, you know, and then Trump campaigned tirelessly.
There's never been anything
no,
like
nothing's like this ever since. And I believe that that actually blunted the Democrat surge. And then finally, Trump was smart enough to realize that, you know, even though we have the, and, well, actually, this did help us too. Even though you would think it should have helped us more, the tremendous economy also helped us as well. And then Trump actually having the boldness to campaign on the immigration issue. That was a winning issue, and that helped energize the Republican independent
base.
Well,
you know, I think he is the one singly to be congratulated for holding on to the Senate, narrow as it was. And honestly, I don't know if we would have held on to the Senate and the House in 2016 if it hadn't been for Trump either. Well, I think he carried
there's
them
at
over.
Least one seat, Pennsylvania, that was almost for sure thought to be lost because Trump won that state. The senator won there. So, I mean, that there's definitely at least there was a in the blue, in the, they called it the blue wall. There was a couple of Senate races in the blue wall states that people feel that Trump pulled over the line. So we were supposed to lose the Senate and people were so pleased to be holding on to it. In fact, they were saying we were going to lose the House.
Yeah.
They said we were going to lose the House and Senate because Trump was such a disaster for the party.
Yeah. But
and in the end, he did have the opposite.
But
he had small coattails in the Senate.
But I think we can attribute a lot of the House to Paul Ryan and more broadly, the Republicans not keeping their promises about the border, not keeping their promises about overturning health care.
Well, the health care was a big one.
Okay, we'll talk more. We're here with Mike Friedenberg from National Review.
Believe it or not, Bob Siegel is aware that there may be one or two people who disagree with his opinions. To offer your own comments on the topic at hand or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, feel free to contact Bob on Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome back to 96.1 FM, 1170 AM. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. So the people of Florida vote in good faith, and one woman ends up attempting to change the election results due to a unique talent for fraud and incompetence that she has shamelessly displayed for so many years in a job that has continued despite the rulings of judges on her illegal, despicable behavior. Is this what's now going on in our country while Democrats continue to squawk about Russian interference? Say hello again to Mike Friedenberg.
Well, Bob, the whole Florida situation is ugly, and it's going to continue to be ugly. I believe we're going to prevail there with both the governorship and the senator. I do believe we're going to prevail.
That may be, but this woman should be locked in jail and she should have been removed years ago. Courts have already ruled against her.
They have ruled against her, but she was reelected last time, a couple years ago, with 76% of the vote.
Do you think it's because she's African American and people are afraid to take her?
I don't know what the issue is, but the bottom line is when you have somebody that's an elected official, you know, you have to be. You know, it's a standard there.
You have to be very careful. It's been proven illegal. No. Not only proven, but she's admitted to it. No. She's admitting to us right now that there are non-citizens votes that they have wrapped up in there. She's going, oh, well, golly gee, I don't know how to separate them. And yet she knows they're in there. You know what's going to happen to her? Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
I don't know her personally, and I'm not, you know, and there's people there, obviously, that are very familiar with that whole county situation. My impression is that she's very arrogant and she believes she's untouchable, but that's just my impression based upon what little information I have. So listen, I think we're going to prevail there still. And if we do, then if you look at the Hyde-Smith race in Mississippi, we should see us end up with a plus two over, so a 53 right to 47.
Well, I hope you're right, and I'll be grateful if it happens that way. I still think that her doing this and getting away with it just emboldens more election fraud.
Oh, I agree. I agree. So I mentioned we want to talk a little bit about Arizona, what happened there. It's very frustrating to see a candidate like Martha McSally, you know, who served her country, who did a good job as a congresswoman, who is a moderate conservative, very in line with the views of the folks in Arizona. You would think she'd be a perfect match. But this goes back to show you just how powerful the impulse is to go against the party of the presidency. I mean, that's one thing. We could sit there and lay the blame on Paul Ryan, and he didn't do a very good job. He did a bad job for us and other things. But the bottom line is there's only been a couple times when you have not had the party of the presidency lose a lot of seats. You know, George W. Bush, right after 9/11, that was extraordinary. He was 86% popularity. But other than that, you do see it go against the swing. Now, that this wasn't it's going to be end up being 35 seats. It was pretty significant. So I don't think we should be patting ourselves on the back right now.
No, hardly.
And however, I did do a little bit more analysis to put things in perspective so that, you know, we're maybe not so discouraged. So, you know, in 2008, when Obama was elected, you know, for the congressional races, there was, 117 million votes cast for congressional races in 2008. All 435 Congress seats. In 2010, you know, that was a horrible year for him. The number of congressional votes from the number of votes for the entire election dropped to 83 million. But what's significant is the Democrats dropped from 65 million to 38 million. Okay, that was a 40% drop. So Obama's first midterm, he saw a 40% drop in votes from the Democrats supporting him. Trump saw overall a 23% drop. So the my point here is, you know, looking at things historically, it was a, you know, we would like to have done better in the House, but there are things that have happened worse. Obama lost 63 seats in 2010. Okay. Trump's losing 35. And that is a lot for a Republican, but the, all the races were close. And remember, the Democrats that won a lot of these seats, the ones that won, were running saying, hey, I like
they
a lot of
running
what Trump
as
does.
Moderates. Yeah.
They weren't attacking Trump. They were talking to, hey, they were open to immigration reform. They were open to, you know, the trade stuff. So, you know, don't give hope on 2020. Now, you know, there's a lot of things.
Well, it's going to depend on how some of these governor races, though, go.
Yeah, and the governor
redistricting and things like that.
And right now we're sitting at having lost six governor races and which is better than they thought we were going to. People were thinking 8, 9, 10. Six was better than we thought we were going to lose.
Republicans still hold the majority.
Yes, we still hold the majority of governorships. So, you know, it wasn't great, but it could have been a lot worse. And holding the Senate is very significant. I mean, so many good things can happen there.
It is, but I do feel we have a president who's almost single-handedly fighting by himself.
Yes. And, you know, for example, with George Bush looking to his second term, because we can't really look at his first term because that was 9/11, but he lost, you know, he had a 35% drop in Republican support from, you know, when he was reelected in 2004 and then the, you know, 2006 midterms. So, you know, this is nothing. What was extraordinary, though, is the amount overall. The percentages sort of stayed the same. It's actually interesting. The, for the Obama, Obama's first midterm, the Republican Party dropped 14%. It was a 14% drop from the presidential to the midterm. In this cycle, the Democrat drop from the presidential to the midterm was 14%. So it's interesting. Exactly, both were 14%. The Democrats voted 14% less in this primary than they had voted in the general. And back in the Obama, the first primary, the general to the primary, they voted 40% less. So we actually matched the drop exactly. The Democrats and Republicans matched the drop. So we're right in it's sort of normal behavior for the elections. Nothing extraordinary except that the 35 seats, they said, they've gone, you know, well, if we could, okay, I will say this. John McCain, with his thumbs down vote on the reform of the health care, if we had gotten the health care reform through, I think we would have lost less House seats.
Between McCain and Romney, two people that both ran and lost against Obama, it's almost like they hate Trump because Trump was able to accomplish what they couldn't, become president.
Well, Romney hated Trump before Trump became president, and people thought Trump was going to lose. So Romney hated him. Romney hated him definitely before he became. But
even then, he had a popularity that's an enthusiast. I mean, supporters that Romney had never had.
And he was actually fighting to win.
Yeah.
And Romney never really did.
No, Romney was asleep at the switch. Okay, speaking of being asleep at the switch, at least Jeff Sessions resigned. We might be able to talk about that a little bit. We'll be right back.
This is Bob Siegel. With the wiring in your home, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. For all you know, he may have gotten his license by sending in three serial box tops.
Hey, these things happen. There's nothing wrong with my wiring. Houses burned down. You wanted a guarantee? You should have ordered the deluxe package.
Folks, play it smart. Call WNS Electric Incorporated. They specialize in contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, WNS takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I use them myself, and I wouldn't call anyone else. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for WNS Electric, license number 480539. WNS Electric.
Listen to this customer review of Bob Siegel's novel, Choice of the Lorelei. I saw this play on which the story is based many years ago. Elements of it have stayed with me over the years as it expanded my imagination about how things might have been in ancient times. It was also very exciting to see this story intersecting with the other works by the author. Very different stories, yet linked by a common element. I can hardly wait for more. Choice of the Lorelei, available in ebook or print copies from Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Briefing last Tuesday's election with National Review contributor Mike Friedenberg.
So, Bob, I do want to go back and talk about the Arizona race a bit. So that was one that's disappointing because we had a candidate that was so obviously left-wing cinema against, you know, Martha McSally, an Air Force vet, a solid Republican, moderate conservative vote, and to lose that race in Arizona, which has a few percentage points, Republican advantage, which for a Republican, that's significant. And if you have a few percentage points, that's usually enough to guarantee victory, was very disappointing. And, of course, you do have the sentiment, I believe, of the independent voters. And here's kind of what I think going back here is I believe that there was a Democrat surge that Donald Trump, along with the Kavanaugh hearings and the results there, was able to get the Republican vote revved up to counter the Democrat surge. But then the independents, still the uninformed independent vote, just said, hey, there's the Republicans have all the houses in the presidency. We've got to vote for checks and balances. Yeah. And they just vote
so that we can have bipartisanship.
Yeah, but whatever the reason was, and they just do that. So we were able to count the Democrat surge with the Republican surge, but the independents still went toward the Democrats. So that's just the bottom line.
You know, I'm an independent myself, but I don't think very highly of the independents, I must say.
Well, okay. So going back here, on election night, McSally was ahead by 0.8 points, 14,000, 17,000 votes, something like that. And I did this analysis the next morning, looking at the 10,000 or so outstanding votes that, were not of walk-in votes that were still being counted. And I looked at the proportions in the counties and I said, hey, absolutely positively, McSally is going to win. Then lo and behold, I discovered these things, these awful things called late earlies. That's the term they use, late early votes.
And the late ones are always Democrat.
Well, it's not good. When I see the term late earlies and there's 650,000 votes, and then I took that they were from Pima County and Broward County, from those two counties. Was it Broward or Macon?
Broward's the one
Macon, the county, I think,
one of the Arizona counties.
So anyway, and I look at that and I'm going, wow, this is not good, because the late earlies are votes that were mailed too late. They came in maybe the election day, so they were very late. They were the last minute early votes. They're votes that were dropped off the day of the election, mail-in votes. So these are all the late votes. And if you look, the pattern is the later votes, the last-minute surge votes, like in Florida, for example, the Republicans were ahead in the early voting, which it was great news to the Republicans, and they still did very well in the early voting. But on Saturday, the day before the voting shut down for early voting, the Democrats came with the late surge. And so I'm thinking, boy, these are probably late surge votes. And lo and behold, now cinema is now ahead by almost 1.5 points. And I expect that gap is not going to get narrower. She's probably going to win by 1.5 to 2 points.
And it's too bad, because she's just a blithering idiot. I'm sorry. I mean, the idea of someone like her becoming a senator, Although there are a lot of senators like her, I should say.
Well, yes, there is a lot of senators like her. So that was unfortunate, but it's still going to be a very close race. So what's interesting about this is that, you know, we lost the Dean Heller race, and Dean Heller was borderline never Trump when he, you know, in 2016. He would not even say that he had voted for Trump or would not support Trump. And we're talking October 2016. Well, unfortunately, Martha McSally is in the same boat as Dean Heller.
And there were a lot of congressmen, too, and Trump kind of rubbed their noses in right. that at a press conference.
And then even as early, as late as January of this year, she was not saying that she was not being able to say that she'd even voted for Trump. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of voters that you have your staunch Republican voters that they get out there and vote for her no matter what. But there was people that were maybe newly energized, more of the Trump voters, new Trump voters that got excited by Trump. They didn't appreciate that. They weren't enthusiastic about her. That hurt.
Isn't it interesting that after 2 years, we still have so many Republican candidates that view Trump as a liability, and yet almost every single time he's proven to be an asset.
Right. And so the Trump voters, and then we had, unfortunately, McSally had a very tough primary, you know, running against Sheriff Joe Arpaio and Kelly Ward. Now, Kelly Ward seemed like a fine candidate. You know, she considered herself to be the true conservative of the race. And then you had this fake Martha McSally running, who was not a true conservative, who hadn't even had the guts to stand up and support Donald Trump. That was Kelly Ward's perspective on things.
And neither of them ended up endorsing McSally, correct?
Right, that's correct. Neither one ended up endorsing Ms. Barbara McSally. So I'm afraid that some of those voters, some of the more, may have not even said, hey, you know, they were angry, the bit of sour grapes, and they may not have voted for Martha McSally. And that makes me angry because, listen, Martha McSally would have been a fine senator.
It's such a lethal formula. It's like, she's not conservative enough. So what are you going to do? Put the Democrats right. in because she's not conservative enough? It's insanity.
So that you get that factor. Then you get the, you know, the independents saying we've got to vote for a check and balance on the power of the Republican Party. And you add those things in there. And it took out Martha McSally, and it's just very disappointing. But I, you know, it's one of those things here that, you know, President Trump at his press conference, you know, pointed out that the people that supported him unambiguously generally did pretty well. I'm not sure if you could extend that to every single congressional district, because I think that's possible. There's some congressional districts where the candidates should be given the freedom not to be mentioning how much they love Trump every time they get in front of the press conference, that he should allow them that freedom. I think there's probably some pretty moderate districts that we would still be happy to take the Republican vote from, even if the guys. Now, I will say that if you are running in a district, you better not be disrespecting the president and saying something bad about him, because you're not going to get through the primary. You're going to be dead in the primary process.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't care for the moderates either, but I'd rather have a few moderate Republicans that will help Trump with his conservative agenda. And even though I had my doubts whether Trump was a true conservative, he's at least a pragmatist, and he's done more for the conservative movement than any conservative president we've had in my lifetime.
I'm going to even include Ronald Reagan.
I do too, and I'm a big fan of Ronald Reagan, but I don't think he did half as much as what Trump is doing.
I mean, now we've been talking about the election cycle, but I'm going to say that one of the things that actually made me that added to my happiness or helped defray any of my disappointment in the House was having Sessions retire.
Yes, boy, long overdue.
I mean, he's been...
Having him there is the next best thing to having no attorney general.
Well, it was actually worse because he filled the space, and I've said this before, and I believe it. I don't believe that there's a single person in this country that has done more to damage Donald Trump than Senator Sessions.
And it's so sad, since he was one of the first yes. people to come out and support him. It's a very tragic story.
I don't know what happened to him, but the only time you ever
some
heard
relative
spoke,
of his speak, ransom somewhere.
The only time you heard him speak about the investigations was to come out and say how wonderful they were.
Oh, yeah.
And how full of integrity.
They've been great, just lining
and
his
so
integrity.
There was something going on there that we'll probably never know.
I think they had something on them, well, I believe.
Well, I
believe we'll never be able to
but
prove that.
But that certainly would fit his behavior pattern.
Yeah, it seems so. Okay, we'll be right back.
This is Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Looking for a place where you can be yourself without having to act more spiritual than you really are? Looking for a church where you can have the dynamics of a large worship service, but the intimacy of a small group? Why not try Skyline Church, located in Rancho San Diego by 94 in Hamasha? I know you'll enjoy the preaching of nationally famous speaker, Pastor Jim Garlow. You can also get to know people through a midweek small group. And for those who want to dig deeper into the Bible, a whole series of classes are offered on Sunday mornings. I teach one of them myself, Forbidden Table Talk, same name as my column, a time to bring up any Bible-related question at all. I would love to see you there. Now, I'm not saying Skyline doesn't have other good classes that you could take as an alternative to mine. I'm just saying don't take any of those. Take Forbidden Table Talk. Actually, you'll enjoy any experience you choose at Skyline Church. Skyline Church, Sunday morning services at 8:30 a.m. and 10:30 a.m. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. I do need to update our Skyline commercials. We'll be doing that soon. But let me give you a little impromptu update right now. The services are now at 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock. And Pastor Jim Garlow has moved into a new national and international ministry. We do have a new pastor beginning there next week. But right now, we're still talking about the election results with Mike Friedenberg.
So there's going to be lots of analysis on this. There's already been lots of analysis. Bottom line is, we're not going to have the House, but I'm going to tell you that I kind of alluded to this last time, and we didn't want to talk about, we wanted to keep the House, but I cannot tell you how many times I've heard, you know, Democrats sneeringly say, why can't you get something done? You control both houses, right? The Senate and the House. And now President Trump can campaign against the obstructionism in the House. It was hard. I mean, we understand why the obstructionism was so effective with narrow margins. But the average person out there is saying, hey, the Republicans control the House, they control the Senate. How come they get things done? Well, now it's going to be very clear cut. The Democrats control the House.
Well, and I should say, when the Republicans controlled the House and Obama was president, they obstructed him. Obama complained about it. I think obstruction's a neutral word. It depends why and what they're obstructing. Sure. Obama had the kind of agenda that they should have obstructed, but Trump had the kind of agenda that should not be obstructed. It's just that simple.
Yes, it's a tool, and depending how you use the tool, it can be for good or bad purposes.
Exactly.
So I agree. So I think that there's some positives here. He's going to hammer on the Democrat House for the next 2 years. I do believe that there's some people that were elected to the House that potentially, because of the way they ran, they might be open to supporting, for example, the new trade.
Well, if they got elected by swinging Trump's way, then they better support him or they will leave in the next
not
election.
Not on everything, but maybe a few cases. For example, the trade agreement he just signed with Mexico. That is, it's not a panacea, but it is better than NAFTA was. And the Democrats should get on board with that. And I think that he'll be able to get the votes on that. And I have mixed feelings about the infrastructure bill. I guess we'll have to see what it looks like, but potentially an infrastructure bill. There's maybe a couple other things that they can. Obviously, they've got to look at the budgets and things like that.
Infrastructure has not been a burning issue keeping me up at night.
So maybe there is some need for some, at a federal level for infrastructure. That's something I have not looked at closely myself. As I said, it's not been my burning issue either. But I did go ahead and take a look ahead toward 2020. Exciting. Now, obviously, 435 House seats are up in 2020 as well. That's always the case. But we have 33 Senate seats up again, as pretty much as usual, in 2020. And in this case, we have 20 Republicans defending their seats and only 13 Democrats. Now, so that's, it's going to be a little bit situation reversed. However, I think that's still going to be a positive for us because we're going to have 20 hard-charging Republican senators trying to get reelected. That's going to create some synergy with the presidential campaign, okay?
If they're smart, it will.
And I'm looking at them, and it's hard to say. I can't point to ones that I can see us automatically losing. They're all ones that we're pretty solid in. There may be a couple ones that the Democrats could pick off, but really, it's a pretty solid group of Republican senators. So it's not going to be easy for the Democrats to come and pick off the incumbents. So in 2020, you know, we're going to have more Republican senators running for re-election. They're going to want to coordinate with the presidential campaign as much as possible, as much makes sense. So, I mean, as I say, it doesn't look like it's, you know, taking out a senator is not that easy. So the fact that, you know, that this election cycle, we were able to take out four incumbents is, you know, was pretty impressive.
And again, I think a lot of that was the Kavanaugh effect.
Yeah. And the Democrats only took care of one incumbent, but they did pick up one seat, one open seat. And that was Jeff Flake's seat. So you're talking about Jeff Flake. Yeah, we're saying goodbye to Jeff Flake. We're saying hello to Kyrsten Sinema.
Yeah, boy, Flake, there's a man who's really true to his last name, I've got to say.
And I don't think Flake did anything whatsoever to help McSally. So
probably not. And boy, he is going to go down, though. He's going to run against Trump in the next primary. I mean, the guy didn't even have enough polling to get reelected in Arizona. He thinks he's going to take on Trump. Trump's going to have him for lunch.
He is not the strongest possible Republican candidate to take on Trump. Nobody is going to be really able, going to be a viable primary candidate against Donald Trump.
Is a Republican. Take down the Clinton machine. He could have Jeff Flake.
Well,
for
he
lunch.
Also took down the Bush machine too.
Yeah, he took down the two dynasties of our country, the Bushes and the Clintons.
I mean, and his right now, he's running in right around 90-92% solid support loyalty among Republicans. So he has consolidated the Republican base. And then there's the independents that almost always
gotta
vote Republican.
Love those independents.
But there's a chunk. There's ones that almost always vote Republican. They probably like Trump. Then there's the ones that always vote Democrat. They don't like Trump. And then you got the middle in the middle. And the middle group, which really, they don't pay that close attention, but we've got to be able to communicate better to that group of people, because what little attention they pay attention to, think about it. We've got CNN, MSNBC, we've got ABC, NBC, CBS, right? All those networks are negative news on Trump, 89 to 90% negative news. And even though Fox is very good and has a great viewership,
Fox
have?
Is balanced, so that Fox will bring on people that don't like Trump also, because they actually are balanced.
Well, whereas we probably normally just watch the cable news networks, there's a lot of people that just also watch, you know, the ABC, NBC, CBS news.
Exactly. Or so, PBS. Yeah.
So just counting on Fox to be able to get the message out by itself, I mean, it's probably 20% of the overall market when you include ABC, NBC for nightly news, all those other groups. So we need to start directly communicating. And my recommendation is, Trump has already raised a record amount of money for his presidential reelection. Rather than spending it when there's all the noise and the advertising rates go up in the last few months, he should start to spend his money over a period of time to highlight the positive things he's doing. No negative, only the positives in key areas.
We should. Okay, we'll be back for one more segment. Buying a home? Selling a home? It goes without saying that you need somebody experienced and skilled, but you also need a realtor you can trust, a man who will look out for your interests as if they were his own. This is Bob Siegel, here to steer you the right direction with just two words, Fred Valduti. Fred works with Realty Executives All Area, a company that has sold thousands of homes locally since 1994. Putting your home up for sale or selling a home can be stressful, filled with decisions you never anticipated. So put your mind at ease and call Fred Valduti. He sold my home for me at top price. Every step along the way, I benefited from his wisdom and a very generous usage of his time. By the way, Fred Valduti received the Executive of the Year Award for 2014. What? You say that was a couple of years ago? Listen, wise guy, do you want to mark the calendar, or do you want somebody to sell your home for you? Whether buying or selling, the man you want is Fred Valduti with Realty Executives All Area, 619 619-771-7. That's 619-719-7717 or fredfelduty.com.
You've already heard some of the wonderful customer reviews of the Dangerous Christmas Ornament, but now listen to some highlights from a professional review by Lisa Ruth of Communities Digital News. The book is literally a page-turner that will delight children and adults alike. Readers will find a piece of themselves in Mike, whom Siegel portrays perfectly. He develops the 12-year-old deftly and makes him real to the readers. They will adore Aunt Lorene. They will remember their first love and the pain of betrayal from a friend. Caligula the cat is a wonderfully clever addition to the story. He steals the book with his caustic insight, making all readers wonder just what their own pets would say if they could talk. The real gift of the Dangerous Christmas Ornament is the lessons it weaves amid the adventure. It reminds us of the social and personal responsibility we share and the repercussions of our actions on those around us. The Dangerous Christmas Ornament has adventure, entertainment, and some extremely important lessons. What more could you ask for in a book?
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
I wish it were a happier election last week, but I do appreciate you coming back to debrief with us and for you showing us the positive side of things, as always.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been much, much worse.
And me picking up
a couple Senate seats, which I think is going to end up being the case, I think.
Well, at least we held on to the Senate.
Yeah, we did.
Narrow as it was.
And we did. And remember, it could have been a disaster election. It was not. And it was, if you take a look at the, you know, the kind of turnouts and things like that, and the historical context, it met kind of the standards of the historical context, except that we managed to pick up a couple Senate seats, which is, you know, going against history.
And it wasn't a blue wave, unless we want to say that the wave was stalled by a great big giant seawall.
Yes, it was not a blue wave election. There's no way. So I think we would be remiss, though, if we did not mention it. And, you know, today is Veterans Day. And, you know, thank you for all the veterans out there who served. And Veterans Day is to thank those that are living, that have served in the country or are serving. And Memorial Day is for those who actually have died serving their country, you know, literally on the battlefield, given their all.
But Veterans Day honors those who are alive and are vets.
But, you know, as I was watching Donald Trump speak today, this morning in France.
Yeah,
I
think, speaking of thankfulness and gratitude, you just gotta love France. They don't sound very grateful for what we did for them in World War II.
Well, the thing is that's, you know, kind of just segues what I want to say. Just watching Donald Trump speak there, it made me think about, you know, the situation with World War I. France and England, they were losing the war.
Well, we bailed them out of World War I and World War II.
And when we did that, for us, it was a cost of 320,000 casualties. And in today's dollars, $340 or $350 million. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot today, but that was a lot of money. And
that was a stupid war we shouldn't have gotten into. World War II was fighting over something. Nobody knew why the heck we were fighting World War I.
World War I would have been something. Listen, I sided with France and Britain on that. But the bottom line is, it wasn't like fighting the Nazis.
No, right.
Then comes World War II. And we spent $4.7 trillion there, and we lost almost 300,000 lives lost, along with casualties and things like that, you know, 670,000. Total casualties, a million. So I guess the point is, starting in World War I, United States stepped forward and became the guarantor of peace for the world. And since then, we have spent over $14 trillion. That's not all our entire defense budget. That's money that, you know, people calculate the extra money we spent to keep the Soviet Union in check during the Cold War. All these wars and battles, hundreds of thousands of deaths and lives. And And then if you throw in the fact at the end of the World War II, we set up trade policy designed to help Europe get back on its feet. Trade policy designed to even help Germany and Japan get back up on its feet.
Right. So in return for this, the president of France says we need to get NATO reignited to fight Russia and the United States. He actually said that.
So trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars keeping the world safe and hundreds of thousands of American lives to do the same thing. So the world does owe the United States a tremendous debt of gratitude, but I don't think that they were going to get repaid for it.
The French would be eating strudel right now if it wasn't for America.
So that's just something that I just think it's good to have perspective on. And something that just this more recently made me think about this is this whole trade policy. A lot of the trade policy that Trump has been trying to reverse direction on came about after the end of World War II. It specifically was designed to help a shattered countries get back on their feet. Well, they're no longer shattered.
Yeah, we need to wake up and realize that we're not living in a certain era anymore, and policies have got to change according to the era we are living in.
And even, you know, when you look at the NATO, a lot of that, you know, a 2% minimum, they are not meeting that requirement, and these countries should be able to meet those requirements. So as we talk about Veterans Day, you know, also remember that, you know, the U.S. people have been footing the bill for the world, you know, since World War I. I mean, nobody has spent more treasure and more blood to defend the rights of other people in the world than the United States has.
And
there's nobody even close.
Whenever our president speaks up for nationalism, which is what this is, he's putting America first, then it gets translated into white nationalism. I mean, he gets accused of racism every time he opens his mouth.
Yeah, that is a utterly disingenuous, dishonest.
It's moronic. It's just people repeating a talking point. They've never even sat down to think about what it means.
Either it's utter ignorance or it's purposefully misleading people.
I think we have people in the media that are misleading people, and I think we have people in the media that are morons. I think it's a combination of both.
So, I mean, it was a very touching speech that President Trump gave this morning. And, you know, as I said, it got me to thinking about all those hundreds of thousands of lives. He actually read from a letter sent by a young man before one of the battles in World War I, and the young man did not come back.
Wow, I did not hear that, but that sounds like it would have been a very
thing. And that's, you know, and that each life has a significant thing. And not only have we had the young men sacrificing, but, you know, sisters, mothers, brothers have had people dying. People in the Gulf War, you know, we've seen a tremendous drop in the death rate, but we've also seen a lot of people coming back with, you know, maimed, wounded, losing a leg. You know, that veteran that, won re-election, the congressman with the eye, he lost his eye.
Oh, the one that they poked fun of on Saturday Night Live.
And, you know, want to talk about
hilarious.
A class act. I mean, he just blew me away.
He was very gracious.
Oh, he was so gracious. That. He said, you know, I don't want people to be losing their jobs. I'm not going to call for apologies. Now, eventually Saturday Night Live, you know, was sort of shamed into bringing him on, and they did apologize, but he's not.
Oh, they did. I had not heard that. Well, good for them.
He doesn't, but he doesn't want every time somebody says somebody that offends somebody for people to be calling for people's jobs.
I agree with that, but I certainly don't mind calling out Saturday Night Live for what they did. I'm glad to hear they apologized, though. Well, Mike, always a pleasure. We'll have you on again soon. I'm sure it'll only be about 5 minutes before there's more to talk about with politics these days. You can't keep up with the news anymore. We'll see you next week, everybody.
Bob Siegel Show, sponsored by Bob Siegel.